This is Shoshana Bryan. I'm the Senior Director at the Jewish Policy Center, and I'd like to welcome you all to the next in our series of conference calls. Today's guest is a special treat for us. I think we're about to learn a lot from Simon Henderson, who is the Baker Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Director of the Institute's Gulf and Energy Policy Program. He specializes in energy matters and the conservative Arab states of the Persian Gulf. Our question line is open today at info@jewishpolicycenter.org. So if you have questions, please send them in, or you can tweet them to @thejpc. And with no further introduction, I would like to turn the microphone over to Simon Henderson. Thank you.
Shoshana, thank you very much, and good morning to all of you out there listening in. Shoshana asked me to speak for a few minutes to make some introductory remarks, and then I'll open up to your questions. I will keep it simple. First of all, in geography terms, Qatar is in the Persian Gulf. It's that finger which sticks up from the southern coast of the Persian Gulf from Saudi Arabia. Qatar is one of the six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, known as the GCC, of which the largest is Saudi Arabia, and the other members are Kuwait, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, often known as just UAE, and Oman. This was set up in the early 1980s after Iran had gone to war with Iraq, or more accurately, Iraq had invaded Iran, where there had just been a revolution, and then there was an eight-year war from 1980 to 1988. It was set up with the encouragement of the United States and Britain, this is the GCC, because they wanted these countries not to be involved in this squabble between Iran and Iraq. And essentially, it achieved that purpose. The GCC has been a useful alliance for the United States to support. In those days when Iraq was a villain as much as Iran, it was very valuable. These days it is a useful counter to the mischief of Iran. There have always been tensions within the GCC, but they've always been, at least in the past, papered over. And the tensions have been various. Kuwait has been a bit of an outsider. Oman is also an outsider. Indeed, if you had asked me at the beginning of the year, was the GCC under threat from internal tensions, I would have said yes, and the problem country is Oman. But a month ago, it became quite obvious that the problem country, for this year at least, is going to be Qatar. Just shortly after President Trump was in Riyadh for a summit with King Salman of Saudi Arabia, a time when President Trump essentially celebrated the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia, also the U.S. support for the GCC, and U.S. Support for the Arab and Islamic nations, which were gathering together with Saudi Arabia in the fight against ISIS. Just a few days after this, the whole thing broke asunder. The circumstances are confused and indeed debatable, indeed contradictory. But it is quite clear that Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain have got fed up with Qatar, who they regard as almost as mischievous and unhelpful as Iran, and decided to break off diplomatic relations, break off air links, shut the land border with Qatar, and then produce a list of 13 demands of the things that Qatar must do in order to retrieve the situation. These demands range from reducing links with Iran to shutting down Al Jazeera, the satellite television station, as well as stopping alleged links and support by Qatar for Al-Qaeda, Lebanese Hezbollah, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and giving compensation to these countries for all the trouble that they've had because of Qatar's support for these groups. There was a 10-day time limit on that list of demands. That would have expired on Monday. Yesterday, the Qataris announced that they weren't going to accept the demands, and today I understand the Saudis have said the demands were never going to be negotiable anyway. This is hugely embarrassing for the United States, which wants to be friends with all these countries. There's a major U.S. base in Qatar called Al Udeid, and which has been very useful for U.S. aircraft operating initially over Afghanistan, then over Iraq, and now in the war against ISIS in both Iraq and in Syria. The way forward from Washington's point of view is to try and use its diplomatic muscle to mediate. The countries concerned, other than Qatar, don't want to mediate. The stakes out there are that this will be vulnerable. This means that the Gulf countries will become more vulnerable to Iran. Potentially there's an energy aspect of this in that any confrontation between Iran and the Gulf states could impact on oil exports. Qatar by itself, although it is a member of OPEC, isn't a big oil producer, but it does have a huge amount of natural gas. After Iran and Russia, it has the largest amount of natural gas in the world. And indeed, at the moment, certainly in the last few years, has been the largest exporter of liquefied natural gas, known as LNG, in the world. That's the general situation. I've tried to give it perhaps as neutrally as I can. I will become more opinionated probably in the Q&A session, which I'm now willing to respond to. And so I turn the microphone back to Shoshana.
Thank you, Simon. I'm hoping that you will become more opinionated. We have a couple of questions. We have a couple of questions here. There is speculation, according to this, in this question, that if Qatar doesn't give in substantially to the 13 demands, that the Saudis might invade and overthrow the emir. Do you think it's possible? Do you think it's likely? And do you think that Turkey or Iran might intervene on behalf of Qatar? And we didn't talk at all about Turkey. So Turkey's relationship with Qatar, I think, is part of the question.
Okay, well, I'll deal with Turkey right at the beginning. Turkey, under President Erdogan, has taken Qatar's side in this dispute. There was an early indication of Turkey's favor towards Qatar a couple of years ago when it was announced that Turkey was going to set up a base in Qatar. And indeed, there is a military exercise scheduled for next week, which may or may not take place. Historically, this is ironic because back in the days of the Ottoman Empire, 100 years ago, the Turks did have a presence in the Gulf and a presence in the territory which is now Qatar. But the Turkish presence in the Gulf was loathed by everybody and isn't the sort of thing that you want to try and replicate, one would have thought, by having a base there these days. It's guessing what Mr. Erdogan is going to do is a fool's game. So I've no great idea. I'm sure we, the United States, are telling the Turks not to get involved in Qatar at this stage, to say and to point out that this will be very unhelpful. Iran is, I would have thought, sitting there on the sides of the lines, laughing at the absurdity of what is going on, and prepared to tweak the absurdity of the events in Iran's favor. It is seeing Gulf unity in chaos, and it is seeing huge embarrassment for the United States. I don't think Iran will want to get militarily involved when so much is going favorably in the right direction from its perspective on a diplomatic front. As regards the core of your question, which was about the possibility of a Saudi intervention, military intervention in Qatar, back in 1995, when the father of the current emir took over from his father in circumstances which were essentially a coup, the father, i.e. the grandfather of Emir Tamim, was in a clinic in Switzerland being dried out for alcoholism, and his son Hamad took over. This annoyed the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Bahrainis because of the precedent of a son overthrowing a father, which was a bad way in their mind of royal families in the Gulf organizing succession. And Saudi Arabia and the UAE at that time plotted a counter coup, which was ultimately a complete failure. But this served to annoy the emir, the new emir then, Hamad, and is no doubt a memory in the mind of Hamad, who abdicated in his favor of his son, the emir Tamim, just in 2013. Could it happen? Yes, it could happen. Would it be successful? I doubt it. The Saudis may, on paper, have a very substantial military. In fact, it's a very bad military and is already bogged down in Yemen. I don't think they have the spare capacity to organize any invasion of Qatar, and it would fail if they did so. And I'm sure the United States would use immense diplomatic pressure to stop it happening, and could, if necessary, display military power to stop it happening. I hesitate to say that the U.S. would actually use military power against the Saudis, though. Back to you.
You mentioned that Saudi Arabia is bogged down at the moment in Yemen. Could you talk a little bit about what's actually going on in Yemen? We hear a lot in the United States about the humanitarian catastrophe, the civilian problem. But at a military level, who's in control and who's winning? Is anybody winning?
Right. Yemen is the country at the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula. It looks comparatively small on the map, but it has a large population, a population which may even be larger than the population of Saudi Arabia, which is about 27 million. Unlike Saudi Arabia, it has very little oil, so it is a very poor country. There are, in fact, two wars going on in Yemen at the moment. The main war is a civil war between a group of tribesmen known as Houthis, who are in an alliance with a previous president called Ali Abdullah Saleh, and they occupy the capital Sana'a, and a substantial part of the population, although in geographical terms it's not a huge amount of the country, but roughly speaking, two-thirds or three-quarters of the population are under the control of these rebels, the Houthi rebels and Ali Abdullah Saleh. And Saudi Arabia, along with the UAE, are leading an Arab coalition to reestablish what they regard as the legitimate government of Sana'a, which is led by a South Yemeni politician called Hadi. He is a divisive character who spends his time now living in exile in a hotel room in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The fighting in Yemen is on two fronts. The UAE have forces in the south of the country, including in Aden, the port city of Aden, which is one of the major cities of Yemen. The Saudis have forces along the northern border of Yemen, but in skirmishes with the Houthi rebels have come off rather badly. There is a humanitarian crisis in that not enough food is getting through to much of the population of Yemen. There is also a medical crisis in that there is outbreaks of cholera, which is apparently spreading, according to the humanitarian agencies. The United States and other countries have been trying to broker at least a ceasefire in Yemen, but the Saudis and the Emiratis don't want a ceasefire because they regard the Houthi rebels as being proxies for Iran, and they don't want to make any concession which could, in their minds, be pursued as a Iranian victory. On top of that, right at the beginning of this answer, I mentioned that there were two wars going on in Yemen. The other war is a U.S. war against Al-Qaeda, which has safe havens in parts of Yemen which should be controlled or is notionally controlled by the UAE. And there, while the civil war has continued, there have also been U.S.-led attacks against Al-Qaeda bases and training facilities in the remote parts of South Yemen. You will probably recall there was a SEAL who died in combat a couple of months ago, and there are occasional news reports of further raids. While the civil war continues, Al-Qaeda is able to take advantage of the chaos to have safe havens, and one fears that they are plotting further attacks against U.S. and other targets in other parts of the world from this vantage point. Back to
Thank
you.
Thank you. The U.S. in some ways appears to be sending mixed signals in the region. President Trump has supported Saudi Arabia, and Secretary of State Tillerson appears to be supporting Qatar. The questioner asks, are the regional players as confused as I am? Are we sending signals that do not allow the Saudis or the Qataris to understand what it is we ultimately want from them?
Well, there have been confusing signals, and memorably a couple of weeks ago, There was an occasion when Secretary of State Tillerson said he was trying to mediate between the two sides, and within an hour or an hour and a half, President Trump had tweeted something which condemned Qatar and supported Saudi Arabia and the UAE. This rather astonished the rest of the world, and as well as people living here in Washington. Since then, it would appear that Tillerson, along with Secretary of Defense Mattis, have got a grip on what U.S. policy should be, and have been trying to mediate. The Saudis and the Emiratis have been trying to claim that the White House supports their view, and people shouldn't listen to Tillerson and Mattis. This is extraordinarily unclear at the moment, but it would seem in the absence of further tweets from the president that the State Department and the Defense Department are leading the U.S. diplomatic efforts on this, and for the moment, that President Trump has backed away from any involvement. Thank you.
Thank you. In a slightly different, well, let's take a different question first. One of the Saudi demands, apparently, is that Qatar close Al Jazeera. We tend to think of Al Jazeera like CNN or Fox, you know, a source of news. In fact, it's a state-owned entity, I suppose more like Pravda. Is it your view that the United States will allow the Saudis to push for the closing of Al Jazeera, or will we insist that it remain, I don't want to say independent because it's not, but remain in existence?
This is an important question, and again, there are sort of a split in the answers. Al Jazeera is really two services. There's an English language service, which many of you who've traveled abroad, not only to the Middle East, but even to Europe, will have found on your hotel television system. And there's also an Arabic service, which is also a news service. The English language service is largely manned by British, American, Australian journalists who often have background in either organizations like CNN or the BBC or other reputable television organizations. And much of that is translated into Al Jazeera English's output. Although, to my mind, it doesn't match up in news terms to either CNN or the BBC. The problem is with the Arabic language service of Al Jazeera, which where the news standards are more questionable, and there are inflammatory commentaries by significant Islamic figures and opposition figures which irritate countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and they want this to be closed down. There's a problem here in that Al Jazeera, government-owned, state-owned, is a sovereign organization, and why should any state shut down a news organization just because other states don't like it? The way forward clearly is to for some sort of compromise, in that Al Jazeera should tone down. It doesn't necessarily have to publicly say that it's toning down, but it should tone down its Arabic language service and be more responsible with it. The Saudi position, which is there's no compromise allowed, the service must shut down, seems to be a demand which just isn't going to work. Back to you.
Thank you. The two words that haven't come up yet are Muslim Brotherhood. Can you talk about the role of the Brotherhood in terms of antagonizing both Saudi Arabia and Egypt? We hadn't really talked much about Egypt, but it's the Muslim Brotherhood connection that's one of the things that's driving the Egyptians crazy.
Yes, it is. There are two things to say about the Muslim Brotherhood. Indeed, one of the more inflammatory commentators who speaks on Al Jazeera is a man called Yusuf Qaradawi, who has said the most extraordinary things. There have been diplomatic protests over the years from not only Arab states, but also the United States and Britain on what Qaradawi says. The Qataris are deaf to these complaints. Qatar has done two things in particular which irritate regional countries. In Egypt, after Mubarak was overthrown and then replaced by President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood leader, the Qataris gave financial help to Egypt, several billions of dollars, and this propped up Morsi for quite a few months, and probably meant he survived. In the end, he survived for 2.5 years before he was overthrown by President Sisi. But he's gone now. Theoretically, Egypt owes Qatar the money, but President Sisi has no intention, I suspect, of ever paying the money back to Qatar. The UAE has its own problem with the Muslim Brotherhood in that to the extent there's any political opposition in the UAE, it is from the Muslim Brotherhood. There's no political freedom as such in the UAE, and so members of the Muslim Brotherhood, especially if they plotted anything against the government there, have been dealt harshly with. There have been arrests, there have been trials, and people have been sentenced. Qatar's position on the Muslim Brotherhood is slightly on the bizarre side. The government clearly regards, and the father Amir Hamad, who's the father of Amir Tamim, has made comments along the lines that the Muslim Brotherhood is the way of the future, which it may or may not be, but it's ironic to hear from somebody who is the leader of a hereditary Gulf sheikhdom, because a basic part of the political philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood is that there is no room for hereditary systems. So the idea that Qatar supports the Muslim Brotherhood is a nonsense, or a completely contradictory, but it's one of those absurdities with which Qatar lives with. Back to you.
I suppose it's like the absurdity of Shiite Iran sponsoring Hamas, Sunni Hamas. I mean, there's some of these things I think are not logical, but that's the way they go. We have two more questions
yes.
in the pot. Let me just suggest to our listeners that we have two more questions in the pot for Mr. Henderson. If you want to send a question, please do it now, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. The next question is, given the blockade on its on goods, is Qatar's economic growth sustainable? Can it do it under the current economic blockade?
An economic blockade is clearly unhelpful. Qatar depends upon imports for much of its food, and so the food will have to come in other directions. Iran has been supplying food or arranging shipment of it. This, of course, can't come by land, which is easier and cheaper, which is the way it was coming across Saudi Arabia. But it can come by ship, and in extremis and rather expensively, it can come in by air. The greater challenge, possibly well, the longer-term challenge for the Qatari economy, is that construction materials need to be imported as well. There's a lot of construction going on in Qatar as the country develops. Indeed, there's much of it is related to the 2022 Soccer World Cup, which is going to be hosted, or at least is expected to be hosted, by Qatar in the capital, Doha. And they need to finish off stadiums and build accommodation for visitors and spectators who are going to come at that time. If the raw material in terms of cement and other construction materials can't get through to Qatar, things will be delayed. And this might impact on Qatar's ability to host this event. But this is rather assuming that the present difficulties persist and persist not only over weeks but months and indeed years. And I hesitate to say that it's really going to happen like that.
Then do you see a short-term, do you see a short-term resolution of this problem?
Everybody is digging in their entrenched positions rather absurdly at the current moment. The Saudis and the Emiratis appeared to think that they were in control of the negotiating position. They're not in control as much as they'd like to be. They handed over this list of 13 demands of Qatar, which Qatar then promptly leaked and to the press, which means that there was a wider debate on whether the demands are credible or not. And then Qatar has now responded by saying we're not going to negotiate on these demands. And the Saudis have said, as I mentioned at the beginning, that they're not going to allow any negotiations anyway. So everybody's got deeply entrenched positions, which are frankly unsustainable. Who knows what's going to happen in the coming few days and weeks? Are people going to see diplomatic common sense? Are they going to be rash enough to consider military action, either overflights by military aircraft or movements of forces on land or indeed naval vessels around in the seas around Qatar? At the beginning of this crisis, I rather viewed it as being a storm in a teacup. But this crisis has had a very worrying tendency to escalate. In the absence of any good news, I think there's a great danger that it will escalate further. The United States will be determined to try and do everything to make sure it doesn't escalate any further, because there's only one winner out there, and that would be Iran. Thank you.
Thank you. In the event that it does continue and possibly does escalate, the U.S. has, as you mentioned, a major air base there. What's the possibility that the U.S. will have to move it? And is it possible to put it in Bahrain, or is it possible to return U.S. troops to Saudi Arabia at this point?
The U.S. has a variety of air bases in or air bases that it can use in the Gulf. It's got at least one in Kuwait. It makes use of Bahraini facilities, both naval and aviation. It's got Al Udeid in Doha, outside the Qatari capital. And it's got at least one airbase and one port facility in the UAE, and also an airbase and port facility in Oman as well. It doesn't actually have any base facilities in Saudi Arabia. Al Udeid is a long runway, which is very important for U.S. aircraft, and crucially, it has what is known as a CAOC. The initials are CAOC, which stands for Combined Air Operations Center, which is really the computers and all the communication systems which enable the U.S. To leverage its military might a long way from home. There are not CAOCs in Kuwait or the UAE or in Oman, so in the short term, Al Udeid is irreplaceable. The Saudi pressure or apparent distaste for U.S. Presence in Al Udeid is ironic. There used to be until 2003, a U.S. use of the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, where there was a CAOC, but the Saudis didn't allow that CAOC to be protected in any way and didn't particularly like U.S. aircraft to fly up to Iraq on bombing missions. And the result was that the Saudis, in the end, asked the U.S. to leave. Qatar stepped in at that point to say, come and base yourselves at our brand new Al Udeid facility. And so this has been going on now for 14, 15 years, and it's worked out well. To replace Al Udeid is neither something which can be done instantly, nor are the range of alternatives very good. I should say at this point that the U.S. does, of course, have aircraft carriers which can come into the Gulf and conduct operations as well, but the limits on the aircraft carriers' ability to conduct maneuvers are that its aircraft need refueling in the air in order to strike targets in Syria or Iraq. And those refueling aircraft have to take off from bases like Al Udeid. So all in all, there's no simple answer to the fact that Al Udeid is very useful to the United States. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one final question, and this one is in a slightly different vein. The Saudis appear reasonably willing to entertain the idea of Israel these days, and certainly entertain the idea of Israel as part of a coalition against Iran and the Shiites. Do you see a possibility of Saudi Arabia entering more formal arrangements with Israel, perhaps diplomatic recognition, or is that still too far for them?
The Saudis have an extraordinary level of relations with Israel. Much of what is simply not discussed. The UAE probably has a bigger relationship with Israel. In both circumstances, and this probably applies to other Gulf countries as well, it combines intelligence exchange on the threat posed by Iran and with security cooperation and liaison, plus a substantial trading relationship. There might be, theoretically, an Arab boycott of Israel, but this is much less than what it has been, and indeed some of the trading relationships are very well established and are frankly substantial. But there's then this great gap of whether these Gulf countries are prepared to have an open relationship with Israel. The problem here is that in the absence of a peace, more substantial and complete peace arrangement between Israel and the Palestinians, the Gulf countries don't feel that politically at home they can get away with an open relationship with Israel. I think this is, they're probably right in this judgment. However, what's changed in recent years, which gives me some hope that there will be further progress in this direction, is that the Saudis and the Emiratis, they don't say this publicly, but make it fairly clear privately, no longer regard the Palestinians as having a veto on their relations with Israel. There used to be a time when the Saudis and the Emiratis and other countries would say, until there's a peace agreement, until you sort it out with the Palestinians, there cannot be a relationship with you. And now the Saudis are prepared, and they do this privately, they're not doing it publicly, to have a level of relationship with Israel which is independent of the Palestinians. The Palestinians have lost their veto right on this. Thank you.
Well, that sounds like a positive note on which to end this conversation. Simon, on behalf of the Jewish Policy Center and the people on the telephone today, I want to thank you for enlightening us and also for confusing us, because I think there is very little in the world at the moment that is more confusing than the situation in the Gulf. But we are better prepared to read the newspaper. We are better prepared to understand what we're hearing. And for this, we are very grateful, and we thank you.
Thank you very much. I will continue to write on this subject. I hope I've got a piece coming out today or tomorrow on foreignpolicy.com. I'll make sure that you, Shoshana, get a copy as soon as I get a copy, in which case please share it with the people on this call and other people that you know.
I'm happy to share it, and I will mention to the listeners, they can find your work on the Washington Institute site, which is, would you give us the web address?
Yes, it's Washington Institute as one word, .org.
And I think to all of our listeners, you should check that out periodically. You will find Simon's work there, and you will find other interesting and useful material there. Again, Simon, thank you very much. This concludes the Jewish Policy Center call for today.